Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back, CJ Evolution. It's episode 61. Thank you all for tuning in. I have a very special guest on right now. Her name is Marnie Grundman, and she is the author of Missing, A True Story of Childhood Lost. And she's been on several, broadcasts, Breakfast Television, Wise Woman Canada, Lifeology with James Miller, and the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And I am just thrilled to have her on to tell about her amazing story. Marnie, are you there?
I am here, and thank you for having me on, Patrick.
Well, thank you for being here. I mean, can you tell? I gave just a glimpse to the listeners about just a little bit about what you have done in your life in writing this book. Can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
The book is a big portion of my life story and the reason that I'm here now and my mission in life. I started running away at a really young age. I was around 5 years old when I actually began running, and I made it stick at about 13. So from 13 to 17, I was actually listed. I was a missing child and I was a runaway. And now my mission and purpose because of that is to raise awareness as to why children run so that we can begin to sensitize people to what's actually going on and remove that judgment.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm assuming prompted you to write this book. Was there anything else that prompted you?
That was a huge portion of it. And then, like all things, as you get into a project or a line of work or whatever it is, it expands. So what began as something that I wanted other runaways to be able to connect to became a mission of destigmatizing them because I realized what a huge stigma is still attached to them. Mm-hmm. And then it became my healing journey. So it's also become that for people that are trying to get on the other side for the most part of, who suffered from abuse as a child or even domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you tell us a little bit, I know it's in your book, can you tell the listeners what drove you to live on the street? And because you had an upper middle class upbringing, correct?
I did. And a lot of people think that children who run away come from, like the slums or impoverished areas. Mm-hmm. And statistically, they don't. Statistically, they're from middle to upper class families. It's a lot more of those numbers. For me, because of the amount of abuse that was going on in my house, emotional was the biggest part of it. There was some physical, there was some sexual abuse. All of those things made me just snap, really. I needed to find an escape. And it's a really sad statement to make when you find more solace on a park bench. You find that to be more secure than a bed in your mm-hmm. own home. And that's what people really need to ask themselves, like, why is that?
And you started out, Marnie, with you ran away several times, and it went back to a very early age, correct?
That's correct. And I was a habitual runner. And that's who I'm addressing. I'm not addressing the kid that runs away, once every, 3 years, and makes it to the corner. Mm-hmm. There's kids that do that, or I'm packing and I'm running and that sort of thing. Habitual runners actually don't threaten. They just go. Mm-hmm. They don't prepare. They just go. Because typically it's a snap. It's a moment. A little extra trauma or anxiety that triggers it. Runaways aren't planners. Mm-hmm. And so for me, any major thing that I sensed coming or that happened, I was out. And I did it very consistently, very consistently.
Now, Marnie, what happened when you started this pattern? What were your parents saying? What were they doing? Were they trying to help you? Were they trying to kind of coach you and kind of convince you to stay, or what was going on at that end?
No. So when I first started running, it was after I was around 5 years old, and my mother had actually dropped me out of a two-story window. I suffered both my arms were broken, and from there I went to live with my grandparents, who were the creators of my mother. Mm. And that's about the time that I started running away, and they weren't really aware of what I was doing because I was left to my own devices. So when school was out, I was running in search of my father, and more times than not, I would get home before dusk, and they had no clue. Yeah. It wasn't until I was about 10 or 11 years old that then I wasn't hiding it anymore. And really, it was 11, 12. And at that point, the police would be called, or they wouldn't call the police, and they would initially search for me and maybe find me in a field somewhere, mm-hmm. trying to hide out. The more I ran, the smarter I became, the better at it I became. But initially, I didn't have that skill set because I wasn't planning ahead, right? They were having me come home. My mother specifically was having me come home because that's what she was supposed to do, not so much because she wanted me there. And this only, unbeknownst to me at the time, only fueled the fire for her in terms of, one, it outed her, it embarrassed her, and two, it gave her an opportunity to paint me as a bad child mm-hmm. and scapegoat me. So it worked against me in every conceivable way.
You know, most of us, you know, will never understand nor have to endure the various traumatic experiences you have gone through. Can you tell the listeners, you know, what a typical day of living on the street is like?
So kids who run are typically a little numb, just so that you know. So the normal senses that you and I feel now, or that people develop over time, like fear, for example, or wanting to accomplish something, those emotional connections. Mm-hmm. Children who run away from home oftentimes they have those skills, but when they're in the runner mode, they're in a numb mode. I spent most of my days the first year between living on a park bench or in an abandoned building. At one point, it was upgraded to a sauna in an apartment complex, which was a pretty good situation as it had, like, you know, a shower and all the amenities we take for granted. And it was bad. I mean, there's days without eating. There's days without hygiene. There's days without all sorts of little mm-hmm. things that we take for granted. No change of clothes and no end in sight.
So if you're how would you advise a young person out there that may listen to this show and maybe they're thinking teetering on whether or not they're going to run away or not? I mean, what pieces of advice could you give that young person?
Well, I mean, for one thing, young people now have something I didn't have then. You know, there was no internet then. There were no resources then.
Sure.
They now have resources that are anonymous that can help them to find a safe space if that's what they need. I think just about every major city throughout the U.S. and Canada now, for example, has a covenant house or has a runaway hotline. I would strongly urge these children to reach out to those mechanisms because you know that you're anonymous and the help that you're getting is from somebody who has either been there or is working with kids just like you.
Mm-hmm.
If you have somebody like a teacher who's not so close to the family that you can trust and confide in, that would be another really great step to take.
Sure.
But if you don't have that person to person, pick up the phone. You know, that's your absolute best option because this is somebody who can tell you what's in your area. If you have to run, you're in fear of your physical safety and you're afraid to report your parents because you're afraid of the aftermath of that, this is the best way to go.
Now, in your book, Marty, you talked about raising a child at such a young age, you know, when you were still away from home and living on the street. I mean, how were you able to raise your daughter at the time?
Well, actually what happened, I was 17 when I had her, and I was pregnant and living from place to place, but I wasn't on the street.
Okay.
Although, I mean, I had a couple places that had no running water or electricity,
sure.
So I might as well have been. But at the time, I'm in Canada now, as you know. At the time, I was living in the U.S., and the laws were such that if a minor had a baby and you wanted to apply for any sort of benefits, you had to agree to social services contacting your parents. And so that's what I had to do. And ultimately what ended up happening is when my daughter was 10 days old, I was sent back to my mother's,
We
all met in Montreal, and then I ended up living with her for all of a week before she asked me to leave. And my grandfather provided other housing for me.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Why did she ask you to leave, Marnie? I mean, you have a brand new daughter. I mean, where did she expect you to go?
Well, thank you for asking that, because those are the pieces that are missing. So to backtrack a little, about 8 or 9 months after I left, and these are stories told to me by other family members, my mother completely packed up my room. My family had money. She didn't spend any of her resources to look for me. There were little posters that, like, they, you know, gave out and that sort of thing. But they could have afforded to take out a billboard. They could have done any number of things. But I think that my mother enjoyed being the mother of a missing child and being painted as the victim. That was her specialty. And so, you know, knowing that she packed up my room 8 or 9 months after I was gone, when I got back, all that was left was a small suitcase, maybe two, of some of my belongings. Now I was staying in the guest room in her house, which used to be my room, and nothing happened. There was nothing in particular. It wasn't even a screaming baby all night, because my daughter slept through the night very early on. Just about a week in, my stepfather came into the room and said, you know, this arrangement's probably not going to be great. Your mom wants to maybe not solicit. Like, he's trying to soften the blow.
Sure.
And my grandfather at the time was a part owner of some hotels and villas. So the plan was to put me in one of the villas, and that's what happened. So it wasn't that I didn't have any place to go.
Mm-hmm.
She couldn't have done that anyway. She would have had to pay rent. She would have had to do something to save. She would not have just thrown me out onto the streets, even though I'm sure she would have liked to.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just who she was and really who she is. I struggled to get my GED after that, taking two buses to go down to sign up when it was a 15-minute drive from her front door and she couldn't be bothered to drive me. So at 17 years old, I want to go back to school, and I have a baby in a huge, you know, one of those big strollers, and I'm carrying it in and out of two buses, taking it down to sign up for my GED without anyone's support.
Well, what it amazes me, Marnie, is that your drive to just move past this the best you could, and knowing that you had to go, and, you know, now you have a daughter to take care of, and you're going to school, and you're trying to better yourself, and ultimately the life of your daughter. You talk in your book about surthrival. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. You know, I strive to live beyond. I don't want to just survive and just be like, you know, all these things happen to me, and, you know, just standing is good enough. Standing isn't good enough. Living is what I need to be doing, and accomplishing things is what I need to be doing, and living well by my standards. And so, you know, to thrive, thriving, you're growing, right? And so survival means that I'm not just merely existing. I'm in motion, and I'm bettering myself in every way that I can every single day, and also trying to give back. That's a portion of it as well.
Well, and I love your book, and I love some of the things that you say. Well, all of it is great, but a couple of things that really spoke to me were, you know, we all hold the key to our self-healing, and you're exactly right. We all have the power to change, to make changes in our life, and you certainly did it.
And I'm doing it. Listen, make no mistake, I'm a work in progress.
Sure.
But I'm no different. I like to point out, like, I'm no different than anybody else. My experiences are different, but I'm no more special or no less special. And that's why I say what I say, that we all have it within ourselves, because if I have it, everybody has it, you know?
But you know, Marnie, too, that there are so many kids out on the street these days that you know, for whatever reason, they don't have the ability. Maybe it's drug abuse or alcohol abuse or whatever. that keeps them down, that they don't have the resources. They don't. You have that, you had, and you still do that inner drive to succeed and to make yourself better. And a lot of kids, as you probably know, they don't have that. You know, they don't have that in their life, and probably because they're, you know, of the people they're surrounding themselves with. Am I wrong?
Or the people that they fall into, not sure. Surrounding themselves with, but it's there's a little luck involved there. For me, I watched my mother. I can't really remember a time she wasn't under some sort of substance.
Sure.
And I saw her, the way she used drugs and alcohol, the way she was anesthetizing herself as being out of control. And that portion made me not ever want to be out of control mm-hmm. like that. And then in the first few weeks that I was on the streets living on a park bench, I was taken in by a prostitute for 3 or 4 days. And I watched how she was living during the day. She would send me out and tell me, when the light goes off, you can come back. And I would sit on the park bench, and I could see her little flat from where I was, and I could see men going, guys going in and out. I still didn't understand what she did. Like, mm-hmm. it, you know, I wasn't exposed to that world. And on the second, third day, whatever it was, she said to me, you know what I do, right? And she had to actually explain it to me, because even the word prostitute didn't resonate so much. And mm-hmm. she said, and the reason that I do it is because I have a drug habit, and I could live better with what I'm doing, but I'm doing this to feed my drug habit, and my drug habit is the reason I'm doing this. And she said to me, I want you to promise me that you're going to go home. And I did promise her I was going to go home, but I just said, I promise. And
sure.
in my own mind, as I walked out of her flat, I said to myself that I would never sell my body and I would never do drugs. That mm-hmm. was really early in my time on the streets, and the result of that is I didn't. Had I fallen into, you know, the arms of some guy who slowly worked me and manipulated me, it would have gone in a very different direction. I got lucky.
Yeah. It's just amazing. I mean, many first responders come into contact with the homeless. You know that.
Yeah.
And young people that run away on a daily basis. I have, Marnie. I mean, I'm a cop, and I've come into contact with many young homeless. I mean, can you give some tips and advice to law enforcement on how to have a positive interaction with these, not just young people, but anybody who's on the street and homeless? Because I think, too, as police officers, we kind of have that stigma, you know, or we have that stereotype, you know, when we're having that interaction.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, because every experience when I ran away, every experience that I had with police was a good one. And it wasn't their fault that I didn't tell them what was going on. I mean, I remember at one point I was hiding under somebody's bed, and this police officer is down on his, like, hands and knees coaxing me out for a pretty extended period of time. And I finally come out from under the bed. Like, it makes me laugh, the scene of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I come out from under the bed, and he's like, you know, we're here for you. We're not here for your parents. We're here to keep you safe. We're here for mm-hmm. you. Can you tell us what's going on? And trying to build that confidence. And I couldn't, because I was afraid of my parents, but he did everything right. The only problem was, and I think it's different now because of resources like the Covenant House, is that the first line should not be returning them home. The first line should be returning them or putting them in a safe space until the home could be evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a gap there, because I think sometimes, maybe in some regions more than others, the police are quicker to return them home than they are to go, okay, this child's not telling me something's wrong, but obviously there's something is.
Mm-hmm.
There's something is wrong. And I really think that as a police officer saying to a child, I'm here for your protection. You know, you're not in trouble. You know, even going as far as, you didn't do anything wrong, I can see there must be something that's making you do this. And really identifying with the person who's homeless and taking the fear away. Because we're afraid we're in trouble. We're afraid we're going to get hauled off to jail. I mean, back then, as a matter of fact, in Florida, it was illegal to run away. That law is since off the books, but it does exist in, I think, about 9 states still.
Well, and I think, and it's important to clarify, you even said, Marty, that, you know, the kids that run away, you know, because they're mad at mom and dad, maybe mom and dad aren't you know, giving them what they want, you know, and we're not talking about those kids that are kind of just being kind of bratty, you know, that probably need to go back home. And, but we're talking about, know what I mean? I mean, you know, talking about kids that are
children, I know.
Yeah, you know, but we're talking about those kids that are suffering psychological abuse and mental and, you know, physical abuse and things like that.
Yeah, and even some of them, you know, when you're approaching them, not all of them are going to be docile like I was. Like, I'm sure, sure. You've run across it. And I find that the ones with the biggest chip on their shoulders are the ones that are the most frightened and the and the ones that are, you know, displaying the behavior that, that has been, you know, put upon them by the adults in their life. And, you know, typically when it's an isolated incident, that child may or may not even come in contact with law enforcement. You know, typically they're found faster than not, you know, and it goes back to, there's a difference between a kid who runs away from home and makes it to a corner or a best friend's house every couple of years, as opposed to a child who's running away 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe even a dozen times a year. Then, like, once it, I think once it hits number three, and it's within the first, like, 6 months to a year, you know you have a problem with it. You know there's something wrong.
Sure, sure. And so being, you know, a good communicator, showing some empathy is probably important, like you said. I mean, is there anything else that you can give listeners out there for, you know, just what else can they do? I mean, directing them to the right resources.
Directing them to the right resources, and also for the adults on the periphery, you know, the neighbors that know the child next door is running a lot, or the teacher that's hearing stories, or the cousin, or the sister, the aunt, the uncle, whoever it may be. You know, a lot of times we get sucked into that drama vacuum where the parent is saying, look what a bad kid, look what a bad kid. You need to start asking better questions and start realizing that when a child runs away from home, they're running away from a bed, from a bathroom, from food, from all of those little creature comforts that we all take for granted. And they're telling you, I'd rather live and starve out in the cold or the elements and sleep on, like, on the concrete than be in that home. And you really need to start asking why and spending time and mentoring that child to gain their trust, to see what you can do for them to help even support the family. Because I'm not always, even with my situation, if somebody could have made my mother go into counseling and gotten us family counseling and put our family back together, that would have been my number one choice in life. I would have preferred to have a functional family and go through the pain of reconstruction, right? And so I'm not for blowing the family apart. I'm for saving the family, but I'm for saving the child first.
Exactly. Well, Marnie, you're such an inspiration of overcoming tremendous odds. Can you give? It's amazing your story. Can you give some advice to the listeners out there on how they can change the negatives in their life? And we all have negatives, you know, in our lives. You know that, and live a life of purpose and meaning, and just overcoming odds. You know, a lot of it's mindset, I know, but anything else?
It's mindset, but it's also healing. We have a big rush to leave the past behind us without dealing with it. And it's not enough to just say, okay, I'm going to wake up today and just think all of the best things. There's a reason why you're stuck somewhere, and you really have to be brave enough to go backwards and really be thoughtful and live through those reasons and grieve those reasons. You can't just put a Band-Aid on it and stitch it up and hope it's not going to bust open again. You need to heal the wounds so that you can have a better mindset. That's why I'm always a work in progress, but that's a big part of what my journey has been, is finally giving myself the permission and the luxury and the time to cry and to be angry and to even feel sorry for myself for whatever time I needed to do that, so that I could move on once and for all instead of keep continually being pulled back.
And I love it in your book how you still struggle with a lot of this. I mean, I was reading in your book about how, you know, it's hard for you sometimes just to not run out the door, you know, so you're still struggling with all this stuff, but yeah, I mean, it's amazing. Like I said, you're an inspiration. And any other words of wisdom, Marnie, for living a life of purpose and meaning? And I think you kind of alluded to being grateful, you know, earlier on. I mean, just being grateful for everything in your life?
Being grateful, and also, you know, this is my favorite thing. It's embrace the fact that you're the strongest person you know. If you've made it through the physical stuff and or the emotional things, and you've made it through to where you are right now, the worst is already behind you. We have a tendency to kind of be like, God, I don't want to be strong anymore. I'm just so tired. And all victims of abuse go through this. This is a really common thread. And I think once you get to the point of embracing that you are really and truly the strongest person that you know, there's a sense of security in that that will always empower you and just lift you higher.
Well, Marnie, again, an inspiration. I want to thank you so much for coming on this show. If people want to reach out to you, where can they find you and your book?
There's a couple of places. So my website, which is Marnie, M-A-R-N-I-E, Grundman, G-R-U-N-D-M-A-N.com. And they can also reach out to me on Twitter under Marnie Grundman. And my book is available on my website as well as on Amazon.
Well, Marnie, you're amazing. I hope to have you on the show again. Thank you for coming on. It truly was an honor.
Thank you so much, and I would love that.
All right, Marnie, take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.